First, I'd like to thank the organizers, for all the organizers, for having me here. And I think this is a great meeting to bring the observers and the theorists together. So I enjoyed it very much. And I learned a lot in the past couple of days, both on science and on many other things. I have to admit, after a couple of days, I become more confused. That's what really are the presenters of Tipon A and how they explode. So, but we still learn something. But that's not the topic of my talk. So I'm going to talk about the nearby supernova rays from our LIGO Observatory supernova search. And the main collaborators in this project are Jesse Niemann, Alex Wilfinkel, and Mohan Galenschlingen. Also, many people in this audience have contributed to both the search and the studies of all the supernovae followed in our search. I especially want to highlight Jesse because this is the part of Jesse's PhD dissertation, and Jesse is over there. So all the works in this presentation are done by Jesse. And Jesse is also an amazing person, even though he's paralyzed from the leg down. But he has overcome all the obstacles in his life and become the supernova rich man in our group. And it has been both a pleasure and a privilege to work with Jesse. So getting back to the search, so here are some basic information about our supernova search. So the search is conducted with KATE, which is a 30-inch fully robotic telescope at the Manhattan LIGO Observatory. And there are many scientific motivations for our supernova search. One is to monitor a very well-defined galaxy sample. And the idea is to both become a search engine, finding lots of supernovae, and also to do photometric follow-up and obtain a photometric database for all types of supernovae. In particular, we keep very detailed log files in our search. And the hope is that we can do statistics for the supernovae and derive a very good nearby supernova range. So in terms of finding supernovae, we certainly have a lot of success, as you can see from here in this table. Basically, we broke the world record along the way. And we also found that in the first supernova in the new millennium, regardless how you define the new millennium. And in the past 5 to 6 years, basically, we discovered an average of about 80 to 90 supernovae per year. So to put this number in the context of all the nearby Type 1A supernovae, here is a plot of the year versus the number of supernovae. And the green color is basically all the supernovae brighter than 19th magnitude, which I see is a nearby supernova. And the red color basically are our supernovae. So we roughly discover about 50% of all the nearby supernovae. And the other half were discovered by other groups, amateurs. There are lots of them. And all the star supernovae in the southern hemisphere. We cannot do anything about them.
You don't mean all the other groups are amateurs, right?
Yeah.
Other groups, amateurs.
Anyway, we also have done a lot of photometry follow-up for many of the supernovae we have discovered. So here is the statistics of all the supernovae. For the supernovae, we do have photometry follow-up, this is the number of supernovae. So for many of the supernovae, we have photometric data points for like 10 to 30 times. And right now, we have photometry information for 125 type 1A, 48 type 2, and about a dozen 1B and 1C. So because we have such a photometric database, then it becomes really impractical to reduce all those photometry one by one by hand. So we think a better idea is to just hire to get a graduate student and chain him to the computer, design some computer code to do all this. So Mohan Galenschlingen becomes a victim of this process. So he's a really smart person. He actually designed the first pipeline while he was still an undergraduate student. So then we tell him, you should become a graduate student, publish all those photometry and all those papers, and graduate in 3 years. And I guess that's very attractive. So right now he's a graduate student in our group. Yeah, right. The idea is, you know, all the superfluid, their flux are somewhat contaminated by their host galaxies. So you should really obtain this template image of this superfluid after they have faded a lot. Then you do this pipeline and subtract this host galaxy contamination so you can measure the net flux you know, for this supernova. And for all this more than 200 supernovae, you do it in a very consistent way, doing the galaxy subtraction, doing all the calibration in the same way. So, you know, so here are some quote-unquote representative light curves from our photometry database. And we have like BVRI colors for colors, and we monitor them from 10 to 20 days before max to sometimes like 2 to 3 months after maximum. So here are some light curves for type 2 supernova, just to impress you. And I especially bring your attention to this type 2 supernova, and this is actually a very useful upper limit. And this supernova is really interesting because you stay on the plateau for only 10 days, then dropped like a rock. Basically, in the next 10 days, it dropped like 6 magnitude. So there are many other interesting objects, not just type 2, but there are also some type 1A. So the hope is that we're going to publish all these interesting objects in our photometry database together with the photometry and all the science. And I know many of you heard me saying that several times, but now I can really hear that someone is beating the drum. Mark said, you know, 32 supernovae in the mid-year. Bob said many, many supernovae. So we're going to publish photometry before they become obsolete. So one day I came into Moore's office and I said, what are we going to do? So Moore saw the desperation in my eyes. So Moore promised me that for the next 3 years, he would work 30 hours a day, 7 days a week. Okay. So anyway, getting back to the supernova race, the benchmark for this study is really by Capinaro et al. In 1999. So they used 5 surveys. One is a visual survey by Bob Evans, and another 4 surveys done by Photographic Place. There are 137 supernovae in about 10,000 galaxies. The normalization is done in the B band, and the supernova rate is calculated as a function of supernova type 1A, 1BC, type 2 as a host galaxy morphology, basically the Hubble sequence, ellipticals, various spirals, and irregular galaxies. And Manucci et al. In 2005 basically redid the analysis. So it's the same database, but now the normalization is done in the K band because it's a better tracer of the stellar mass in the galaxy. They also measure the star formation rate as a function of galaxy B mass K color, which is a better tracer for the star formation rate in the galaxies. So we're going to do all this exercise in our rate study. So in a nutshell, so here are the number of supernovae involved in our rate calculation. A total of 844 supernovae were observed, among which 600 were our own discoveries. Another 240, they were discovered by others first, but then we recovered them in our search. So certainly we should include all this in the rate calculation because we did discover them. And when you break this total number of supernovae in the subcategories such as 1A, 1BC, and type 2, and for their host galaxies, whether they have B-band or K-band luminosity information, then the total number of supernovae we used in our rate calculation is around 600. So this is about 5 times the number used in the C99 study. So how to calculate the rate? So it's really simple. You divide your number of supernovae discovered by the total luminosity you are monitoring and the total monitoring time you have. So this is really fifth grade mathematics, but Jesse kept coming back to me, this is a lot harder than fifth grade mathematics because it took us 8 to 9 years to find the 600 supernovae. The total luminosity you get from the magnitude and the distance to a galaxy. So it's very easy to do for one galaxy, but if you have 20,000, then it becomes a little harder. And the trouble especially is the monitoring time, you know, how to calculate the monitoring time. And we use the method called the control time method, and which is, I think, is invented by Fred Zwicky half a century ago. So the idea is for one epoch of observation, if you image one galaxy at 100 megaparsec and you reach a limiting magnitude of 19, so everything brighter than negative 16 should be in your image. And then for your adopted light curve, for example, 1B, 1C, it means from 10 days before max to 20 days after max, it should be visible in your image. That means in this one epoch of image, you control 1BC for 30 days. And then for other, for 1A is 125, for type 2 is like 130 days. So this is just one for one epoch. So when you have multiple epoch of observations, basically means you are monitoring these galaxies, then things become a little bit trickier, because for example, you have T1, T2, and T3, each is 130 days, but there are also observation intervals here. The total control time then really becomes 130 days for the first epoch, but then you have to use the observation interval for the second and third epoch, because those are shorter than your control time. So the idea is that you should use this control time, the observation interval, for the control time as many as possible, because those don't have uncertainties. It's just T1 minus T2. And this is especially true for our search, because here's a distribution of the observation intervals versus the numbers. And you can see the majority of them are less than 10 days, and the peak is something like 5 to 6 days. This means we can use the interval most of the time for the control time, especially for 1A. So 92%, we can use the interval as the control time, which means a linearly continuous search coverage for the 1A. It means the light curve will have very little influence on our reach. But for type 1BC and type 2, we do have to use the light curve to calculate the control time, much more, about one third of the time. So we are very concerned about the light curve, how you use the light curve to derive the reach. So since we have such a huge photometer database, then basically what we did is to take the average light curve for 71A, a dozen 1B, 1C, and half a dozen type 2. So we use this kind of a light curve in our reach calculation.
This is unfiltered, right?
This is filtered R-band. It's really from our photometry, yes, because our search is done in unfiltered, so it's very close to the R-band. So the choice of a light curve is very important. We consider it a major source of uncertainty, especially for 1BC and type 2, and it's different from C99. But we are also calculating using the C99 light curve just for comparison. And we're in the process of determining more accurately, because we do have more photometry for more superlovely. And one caveat of our reach calculation right now is that we didn't consider extinction or the luminosity scatter of the superlovely. But I have to emphasize, because we are using the observation interval for the control time, especially for 1A, most of the time. So within a certain range of the extinction and the luminosity, as long as your observation interval is always short enough, shorter than the control time, then we're still doing that. So the effect to the 1A reach will be much less than to the 1BC and type 2. So we also calculate the limiting magnitude very carefully for every single image, because we have very detailed log files. So for example, we do the seeing condition, the intensity in that image, and the sky background, and stuff like that. So this is not done for previous study reach calculation. They just assume a grand one limiting magnitude for the whole search, regardless whether it's partly cloudy or cloudy or clear skies. So I think this is also a major improvement. So we also are concerned about all those different observation bias, such as whether there's an inclination correction effect, because the previous study used many photographic plate surveys. So for the very highly inclined galaxies, many of the supernovae are missed in this disk of the galaxies. And for us, we actually probably found an inverse correction, because here is the rate for the face-on galaxies, inclination is very small. Here are for the edge-on galaxies. So if anything, the edge-on galaxies have a higher rate than the face-on galaxies. So we didn't do any corrections. Another thing is we are concerned whether we miss all the supernovae in the center of the galaxies. Again, this is a concern for the photographic place, because in the center, the galaxies were often overexposed, so you miss the supernovae. And we did a very careful radial distribution for all the supernovae discovered, and it seemed to follow the stellar density very well. So our estimate, we probably missed about 1% of the supernovae in the very center of the galaxies. So it's really negligible in terms of the error bar for the race. So I hope I've convinced you that we are right now deriving, quote unquote, the grandest nearby super rate. And before I show those results, let me just remind you that the unit, because it can be confusing at times. So one SNEO is basically one supernova per century per 10 to the 10 solar luminosity. And one SNEOM is one supernova per century, but per 10 to the 10 solar mass. And here is very, very, very important. I hope this was a lot of screaming at you, but really, what's here taking upon a few things, because especially the error bars, because these are really our preliminary results.
Turn off our cell phones.
Yeah. But here are the results. Basically, this is the normalization done in the B band. So this is quite busy. But here are the haplotype and supernova rate. Focus on the red dots first, because this is our optimal rate. So here, the optimal north rate. Here, the red and purple is the same. So this is the north rate, and this is our loss rate. The purple is also our rate, but using the C99 net curve. So for 1B1C, for example, we are using the same net curve. So basically, the rate are the same. And the blue triangles are the rate by C99. So at the first glance, you compare the red dots to the blue triangles, basically our preferred optimal rates, and the two rates are actually pretty similar, except perhaps in the 1B1C, in the late type spirals, our rate is a little bit higher. But if we are using the same net curve as they used in their rate calculation, if we compare the purple curve to their rate, then our rates are always considerably higher. So it really depends on what kind of light curve you use for the rate calculation. Another thing we noticed is for the 1A rate, using the B band luminosity from elliptical to irregular galaxies is nearly constant. There may be a little rise, but it's nearly constant. So here are the results for the key band using the key band luminosity normalization. Again, the difference and the similarity between the C99 and our preferred rate is the same as in the B-band luminosity. But now for the 1A, which I think many people are interested, you really see an increase of rate from elliptical to irregular galaxies using the key-band luminosity. There's an increase. Another thing you notice is in this irregular galaxy band, so we do find some supernova in the irregular galaxies. Even though the two numbers are null, you can still calculate the rate. So from the rate, you can see our rate is definitely lower than the Malucci 2005 rate, even though their rate has a pretty large error bar. But here you can see the trend is pretty kind of linear. And in the Malucci, it has a huge jump to the irregular galaxies. So since we have so many supernovae, so we can afford to put them into more galaxy bins. So here's what I did. This is the B-band normalization. This is the key-band normalization. So in the B-band normalization, you can see still the 1A rate is nearly constant for all the galaxy types. And for all the core collapse supernovae, basically I add all the 1BC and type 2, and it's very peculiar, has a rise from S0 to SPC, but it's nearly constant for the late spirals. Using the key band, it's always rising for both types of supernovae, but then there's a weird turnover for the core collapse supernovae, so it's a little bit bizarre. So we also did the rate using the per unit mass versus the galactic color. Basically, it's the star formation. So this is per elliptical galaxies. So those are the irregular galaxies. And the rate, if it's perfectly proportional to the mass, it should be a constant. So it seems to be flattened out when you go to elliptical galaxies. But there's another component that's properly proportional to the star formation rate. So we had this two-component model, which confirms earlier studies that one component is properly tardy, it's just proportional to the galaxy mass. But there's another component which is proportional to a fraction of the core collapse supernova rate. So another thing we did is basically we plot our nearby supernova rate on this rate versus redshift evolution. So I don't know what I can see more here, because we just added one point to this diagram with probably a much smaller error bar. But see here, which is our concern, we have five more times of supernovae. This is our data, this is C99, then the C99, and all our systematics are much better controlled, yet our error bar is, I expect a much smaller error bar. But here it's a little bit smaller, but not by much. So I think we are in the process, GSE is in the process of trying to understand how to interpret this as a function of supernova delay time and the cosmic star formation history, as you know, that is done by previous groups. But I don't know, you know, the new results from Jesse. So just to summarize, so our uncertainties are significantly reduced. I don't want to get into the details. But for the 1A supernova rate, for the B band, it's basically independent of the host galaxy morphology. For the K band, it's increasing to the from early to late type galaxies. Using per unit mass, there are two components, one prompt component and one tardy component. For the 1B and 1C and all those quirkable supernovae, using both either normalization, they always increase from early to late time galaxies. Using the per unit mass, they seem to follow the star formation rate of these galaxies. And our 1BC rate is higher, type 2 rate is a little bit lower than previous studies, but this is really dependent on the choice of light curves. And the future refinements, we want to put to get more and better light curves, we want to put the supernova in more beings, and we want to consider extinction and luminosity scatter in the future. I'll stop there.
Thank you. I'll take the first question. How did you determine your efficiencies, your limiting magnitude? Did you actually do simulations, or you planted supernovae in the data? Or was
yes, we have photometric calibrations for many, many fields. So you know, basically, we know the brightness of all those stars. So basically, we inject fixed stars to every single image, and then determine you know the limiting magnitude for all those fields. We do know the calibrations. Then we have we basically determine the correlation between this limiting magnitude to a lot of other parameters, such as the seeing in that image, and the intensity in that image, and the sky background in that image. So we get an RMS of plus minus 0.5 magnitude, which is still fairly large, but it's much better than previous studies.
Okay, and this effect that there's an inverse dependent on inclination, what do you make of that? What could cause this?
We are doing galaxy subtractions to discover the supernovae. So I think the idea is that we probably haven't missed a lot of supernovae. That's my sense. So maybe for this highly inclined galaxy, maybe we are seeing them all. You know, they're, for the Fison galaxies, some supernovae is hiding, for example, behind the disk. And because rather than extinction and stuff like that, you are actually missing some of those supernovae. But that's just my guess. I have no you know, grand idea about why there's an inverse inclination effect.
The Sullivan paper from the Legacy Survey found a normalization with star formation rate that was about a factor of 3 lower than Minucci. So I'm trying to see, it sounds like if you compare to the Minucci result, just in terms of the 1A rate versus B minus K color, were you lower than Minucci?
You mean, do you know the normalization between the 1A rate and the core collapse supernova rate?
Yeah, your normal look like that ratio was comparable to what Minucci had found.
Yes.
But then the question is, did your 1A rate as a function of the B minus K color of the galaxy, was that lower than what the Minucci rate had?
They are actually consistent with each other. I have this like SUM in elliptical galaxies, both for Minucci and from ours. And they are consistent with each other within the errors. Maybe lower, right? Yeah.
Roseanne?
Yeah, since you have this wonderful sample of supernovae in nearby galaxies, it seems like a unique opportunity to also try to learn more about the regions where these are occurring within the galaxies. You know, for example, maybe in the edge-on, you're finding more of them above the galactic plane, and may even be able to do, you know, get the rate as a function of distance above the plane. Are you working on that element of it just to try to relate the environments of the supernovae to try to understand more so that you can look at those statistics as well?
Yeah, those are, I can only say it's a work in progress. And basically we are trying to understand, for example, the supernova rate, how they change depending on their environment, whether they are in clusters or in field galaxies, whether the host galaxies have radio properties, and whether the host galaxies have more galaxy activities, aging activities, stuff like that. I think Jesse is looking into all this. In terms of radial distribution, I'm not aware that we have any plan to do that, but that's an excellent suggestion. Yes, yeah, and in fact, one of our crew here, Ryan Sherlock, thought about that too, so you know, we were looking into that.
Okay, thank you, Weidong.